Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. Hello and welcome. I'm Denise Foles, and we're back again. We have a wonderful show here for you tonight on this series for 2017 of Awake in Birth. My guest tonight is really a star. She is just one of the real pinnacles of parenting, and she really knows her stuff. This is a very smart woman. She makes me sit up straighter. And her new book is out, and the new book is provocative. It is so informative, and we have so much information to share with you tonight. I know you're going to want this book on your personal bookshelf because that's where it belongs, because it is a point of reference and resource for a long time to come. Kimberly is a great friend. She's a person that's always available and always ready to give somebody some advice and really has that can-do attitude. So tonight, my guest is Kimberly Seals Allers, and she's part of Mocha Mom. She's actually founded Mocha Mom. She's been talking about motherhood for a long time before it was chic, as the word goes. So we're going to get some history here tonight. The call-in number is 323-870-3891. That's 323-870-3891. You can also join us here on Blog Talk Radio online. There is an event page set up on Facebook that is the title of the book. So if you have any questions or any statements you'd like to share with Kimberly, that's the perfect place to put them because I'll make sure that we have them on the air tonight. Hello, Kimberly, and welcome.
Hi, how are you? Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, yeah. Kimberly, like I said in the introduction, you know, your work is absolutely fabulous, and you've been in the arena of parenting and motherhood for a very, very long time. It started with you with Mocha Moms, correct?
Well, it started with me really with Mocha Manual, which was like my first book.
From
having this idea around creating a series of books for women of color, the first one being the Mocha Manual to a Fabulous Pregnancy, that really kind of landed me, you know, in the space of, one, looking at motherhood, mostly at that point to the lens of pregnancy, but also kind of thinking about the ways that our experience may be a little different.
Wow. Okay. And mm-hmm. Your children are how old now?
So now my babies are 16, and I have a 12-year-old who's turning 13 next week. So they are bigger babies, but still challenging, but just wonderful children. They bring me a lot of joy.
Wonderful, wonderful. So now between the time span between the Mocha Manual to the Big Letdown, how long has it been since you put something out in publication?
Well, the Big Letdown is my fifth book. So the first Mocha Manual was about 10 years ago. There were three Mocha Manuals in that series. I think the last one came out maybe 2009. And then after that, I co-authored a book that was really about looking at implicit bias in the workplace and what that does, you know, for people of color and how they are leaving corporate America. And then this book, The Big Letdown, you know, as you know, just came out this year. So it's really been, you know, over 10 years that I've been writing books and, you know, feel really blessed to kind of have had a good run and continue to find things that I'm passionate about and that people are interested in.
Okay, wonderful. So now, Kimberly, just in case we have some people, some listeners rather, who are not really acclimated to the work that you do or have been exposed, could you just tell our listeners your background with your education as well as your professionalism?
Mm-hmm. So I'm a journalist by trade. You know, I'm a graduate of NYU and Columbia Graduate School of Journalism. And, you know, for years I had an amazing and blessed career as a business journalist. I was a writer at Fortune magazine. I worked at the New York Post for many years. Rupert Murdoch sent me to London to work for his newspaper, The Times, in London. And so I was really kind of busy doing my thing, you know. And like many women, I became a mom and everything shifted. So I became very interested in kind of looking at, motherhood through that lens. I was also a senior editor at Essence magazine for many years. That was my last, you know, staff position before I started doing my own thing and writing books. But you know, what was interesting about, you know, when I became pregnant as a journalist, I think I applied that journalist over-reporting, over-research approach to pregnancy, which, by the way, can be very dangerous. You don't want to over-research everything. But I became, you know, really aware and, you know, quite frankly, very concerned because I never considered myself a risk, right? So I was blessed to not have been of low income at that time, you know, blessed to have been, educated. So really wasn't thinking about that. And when I saw all the statistics about how, you know, even college-educated Black women have the same poor birth outcomes, still twice as likely to have a low birth rate baby, still three times more likely to die during childbirth, like all of these adverse outcomes, you know, as the same as perhaps our disadvantaged sisters, it was really frightening to me, right? So among white women, education and income do improve their birth outcomes. They are protective, but for Black women, they are not. And this was, you know, really troubling for me, and I was really curious about why this was happening. So, you know, as a journalist, I wanted to kind of delve into that and to figure out why, because, you know, there was no, you know, like baseline medical reason, but it was really all about, you know, some of the sociological issues, the stress that Black women deal with. You know, I don't mean during the 9 months of pregnancy, but lots of the studies really showing that, you know, because we kind of deal with racism and stress over our lives, it weathers our bodies and we enter pregnancy in a less healthier state, even if we are appear to be healthy by some very common metric. So I just found this all fascinating. So I really wanted to write a book that could support Black women, you know, through that journey of pregnancy, not really looking at it from a medical perspective, but definitely looking at it from a sociological perspective and thinking about what's going on in our lives that may be causing undue stress, whether that's your finances, whether that's your relationship, whether that's your workplace, whether that's a pre-existing condition. What are those things? So my first book, The Mocha Manual to a Fabulous Pregnancy, was really about, you know, kind of creating a guidebook to help, you know, women of color manage the other, right? So I'm not a doctor, but had a lot of experience in the other, in my own life, and wanted to bring that to a book. So that was, like I said, my first foray. It was published by HarperCollins. I was, you know, really fortunate to land a strong book deal for my first time. I was still at Essence at the time. And, you know, that book was nominated for an NAACP Image Award. You know, it was turned into a DVD that was sold at Walmart. You know, it really was an important and substantive work at its time. So I was really glad about that. And I think most people were just really thrilled to see, you know, images that look like them on a book, you know, which, you know, 10 years ago was harder and harder to find. So, you know, I was really proud of that. And then the Mocha Manual series went on to continue the second book being about turning your passion into profit, which really kind of chronicled my journey a bit, like leaving Essence and starting the Mocha Manual brand, but always bringing in the stories of other women to, you know, kind of look at that. And then the third book in the series was about the Mocha Manual to Military Life for Female Service Members. So, you know, I've always wanted to be of service, and so being able to use my writing to do that in different areas of women's lives has been a real joy. And, you know, I'm really pleased to continue that work now with The Big Letdown.
Wow. Wonderful, wonderful journey. And I went to your book signing in New York, and you graciously complimented me with the copy to review and have you on my show. And once again, Kimberly, thank you for your kindness on that. I want the listeners to know a little bit more, something intimate about you. And at your book signing in Manhattan that night, you talked about Kimberly, the little girl. Do you remember what you said about yourself?
I do remember what I said about myself. Thank you for reminding me. You know, I was really thinking about my parents because I was a weird kid, right? You know, I played the violin. I was really into bird watching. You know, I loved to write and read anything that I could find. You know, my dad bought me, you know, typewriter after typewriter and notebook after notebook. I made fake radio shows that I recorded where I was the host and the guest. You know, just a lot of interesting things going on. And what I was saying was that my parents never made me feel weird. You know, like in retrospect, I'm like, I was a weird kid. But what I'm grateful for is that my parents never made me feel like I was weird. You know, they've always kind of encouraged and supported me, you know, even though I feel that, you know, from where they came from, they were probably looking at me like, where did this kid come from, you know? So as a parent, I could appreciate that, you know, it's really, really important. I'm very grateful for that, you know, that I never felt weird, even though I had, you know, unique interests and I was, you know, out doing my fake radio shows and, you know, producing a fake newspaper for my blog. So when I was like in writing poems all the time when I was 7 years old. So, you know, it's really amazing how childhood is so important. I mean, this is the thing about parenting, right? Like, your childhood is the part of your life that you, you know, literally have no control over. You just got to hope you win the parent lottery. But it's so formative. It so shapes you. And obviously, you know, in negative circumstances, people can spend, you know, much money and many years of their adult life trying to kind of, you know, undo their childhood. So I'm very grateful that I had a wonderful childhood. You know, it's very true, you know.
I had
a wonderful childhood. My parents had been married for going on, 58 years this year. And, you know, I'm very grateful for that experience because, you know, it's not something to be taken for granted, you know?
Absolutely not. And I wanted to bring this up to our listeners because March is Women's History Month. And Kimberly has a very rich background and perseverance and unique and standing up to her uniqueness and owning it and embracing it and forging her uniqueness into something that is benefiting so many people. So that's why I wanted her to share what she said about her childhood at her book signing. I was there with her family. I was graciously invited. I got to meet her family. They're wonderful people. And what Kimberly's saying, it happens for many of our young girls out there today, that they feel different. That they feel odd, they feel weird or strange because they're doing things that maybe many of their peers are not doing. And Kimberly's response or her reflection back on her own childhood really comes back to me because I was the weirdo in my family. I was the strange one, and my parents completely allowed me to be who I am and supported me in everything that I wanted to try, education and music and travel and wonderful adventures like that. And so, you know, I put you, Kimberly, up there with Shonda Rhimes, who I had the opportunity to listen to her biography, and I call you first, only different. So, yes, to do the work that you're doing.
Thank you so much.
You know, if you ever have a chance to hear Shonda Rhimes' biography, Kimberly, you know, women like us are weird and odd. Yeah, but we're first and we're only different, and that's okay. So for all the listeners out there who have little girls and they want that guitar or they want that insect bug kit or whatever it is, get it for them because you never know what their lives will bring them to. And here Kimberly is from the days of her notebooks and her typewriters, her father bought her. She went to Columbia. She became this fabulous journalist who's had, you know, international success with some of the biggest, you know, houses in publishing and communications. And if her parents didn't support her in that, could you imagine what Kimberly would have been?
that is such a powerful thing that you're saying, Denise. I really appreciate you, you know, kind of taking me back to that reflection because, you know, I said it, but, you know, the way that you're saying it really is even adding another layer of meaning for me, you know, particularly as a parent and what you're saying about kind of being okay to be unique, which, you know, is something often that someone has to let you, right? You know what I'm saying? It's like it's not something always that you have. Sometimes you need at an early age someone to say that's okay, you know, whether that's spoken or unspoken, but allowing that to happen. And it's so interesting how great that you had a similar experience. And you know, it's a beautiful experience to have, and I'm very clear, as I see that you are clear, that that has helped us kind of, you know, as that uniqueness has taken on different forms throughout your life, that you've been okay with that, you know. For me, like, leaving Essence was a really big deal. People thought I was crazy, you know, and, you know, it's like, why would anybody, you know, why would any black female journalist leave Essence? And, I mean, I loved my job so much, so much, so much, but, you know, I was going through a divorce, and I realized that I could not be the mother that I wanted to be with this job, you know, this job that I loved, and I made a conscious decision to really try to figure out how I could be present for my children, particularly during that tough transition of divorce and, you know, what that can what that can do to children. And, you know, here I am 9 years later, still, you know, still kind of doing my own thing. But it's been a blessing for me to be not afraid, because it was, of course, a time of big fear, you know, for so many reasons.
Yeah.
But for me to have confidence in myself that I could figure it out, you know. Obviously, a lot of planning. I'm not talking about cold turkey, you know, going one day and kick over a wastebasket and quit. That's not the way it happened. You know, there was a clear plan, and I mapped it out and things like that. But ultimately, you know, kind of like overcoming the fear of leaving such an established brand, leaving, you know, what I call the golden handcuffs of direct deposit every other Thursday, a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing. But you know, being free to walk away from that and feeling confident that you can, you know, figure it out on your own is something also that I would certainly credit to that experience helping me kind of blossom into that place, you know?
Absolutely. And I'm going to tie it in even further, listeners, and to my wonderful guest, Kimberly. Kimberly did all of this in her life and made these transitions with the self-esteem and awareness that she had from her parents, gifting her with this freedom of expression and individuality and love. That's what it really is. It's love. And here Kimberly came, you know, let's fast forward many years later. She's writing a book about something that is still basically frowned upon and women still have hang-ups about, and that's about breastfeeding their own children. So, you know, Kimberly's work was a product of her own self-esteem and her own individuality and her strength. Women in breastfeeding have to also have that strength and to come forward and say, I am feeding my baby. This is a part of me. I'm giving my baby my milk in public, uncovered, unashamed, and it's natural and it's fine. So once again, we have to step out of those comfort zones in our lives. But it also comes down to how are we supported in our communities? How are we supported in our families? Mm-hmm. And if that woman who's breastfeeding, when she takes her breast out to feed her baby, still modestly covered up or however she chooses to do it, if her family supports her, if they send her to another room, if she's out in the street, however it is, however her community is supporting her, we still have a long way to go with that here in 2017. So once again, Kimberly's stepping out on writing something that is really very provocative and still giving society major challenges today. From the time that women weren't allowed to show their ankles, well, guess what? Hundreds of years later, women still cannot show their breasts to feed their children, but they can show their breasts for our Victoria's Secret ad. So let's go into this book. Now, this book is called The Big Letdown, How Medicine, Big Business, and Feminism Undermines Breastfeeding. This book, I read this book. I marked up along the borders and margins of this book. I cannot share with anyone else because it's mine. This book has got to be the first book that I've ever encountered in doula work that has the most information on the history and where the conception of formula feeding to breastfeeding, back to formula feeding, back to breastfeeding. In other words, Kimberly has done her job as a journalist. The diligence is here in this book. The first four chapters alone is going to wow you because I did not know all of this as far as how formula came to be in this country. I didn't know the science behind it. I didn't know the capitalism behind it. I didn't know the marketing strategy behind it and how our history basically pushed a bottle of formula into our baby's mouth here in this country. But Kimberly's done an excellent job of writing this out. So I'm saying to all the listeners, if you are an IBCLC, if you are studying for your CLC, if you are in med school, if you are anywhere with women as a support of lactation, you have to pick up this book and read this book because nowhere else have I been able to find this amount of succinct history and facts put together so well. So I just wanted to say that. Now, in getting into the book, as I told you, I underlined things. I highlighted this book is mine. At the beginning of the book, Kimberly writes, breast milk is actually lies. Now, could you imagine that? Because we talk about things in our bodies in description. Oh, you know, she made me so sick I vomited. Oh, I vomited in my mouth. I was so disgusted by that. Or my tears of remorse, my tears of joy. Imagine saying my breast milk flowed to my baby's waiting suckle or something like that. You know, in other words, Kimberly basically put tears, vomit, feces, sweat, the sweat of your labor. She put breast milk right up there in those body fluid categories now.
So I don't know if that's what I meant, but I certainly thought of it as a kind of a changing organism. You know, I see breast milk as food. It is something that changes. You know, it is not static. It is dynamic, you know, and it changes daily and probably hourly. But, you know, I mean, nothing that that changes that way or adapts that way or, you know, moves that way can be dead, right? So that's what makes it alive for me, in that it is so adaptable. You know, it is moving, but it's also changing. And, you know, when something is static and unchangeable, you know, that's a sign of kind of death. But when something is living, then it moves and changes and goes through adaptations with you. So, I mean, it's just such a miracle thing. I mean, I don't know whether we'll ever fully understand, you know, all that is the complexities of breast milk, but it is extremely fascinating, and that could be a whole nother book.
Yeah, no, right? So I just when I read that sentence, I'm like, yeah, it's right up there. When someone says, you know, the sweat of their labor, it's like, yeah, I understand that. And now we have this concept coming in, well, you know what, breast milk is the same level of that intensity of our bodies. You know, I just thought that was really powerful. Kimberly mm-hmm. also goes on to say, breastfeeding shows us all the ways of women that we have been imagined, constructed, created, and controlled by economics, science, the media, and other so-called authoritative sources. Kimberly, let's talk for a minute about that. First of all, I want to know, what did your book publishing or your agent said when you first thought of this concept to even do this book? What did you get any kickback? Did you get a reaction like, oh, really? What was the reaction you got?
No, you know, I really have to say, and thank you for asking, because, you know, I don't mention this enough. You know, I'm supported by amazing women, right? So my agent is a woman, and my book editor at St. Martin's Press is a woman, and she, you know, fought hard. There were, you know, to be honest, there were other people interested in this book, and she, you know, fought to make it to, you know, to work on the project. So, you know, I found that when I started talking about it, most, like any woman who has had a child, got it immediately, you know, because everybody's had that experience of being let down, like something is not right here, you know, either something wasn't told to me, or I didn't know about the experience, or someone who I thought I admired said something really ignorant, you know. So I think what was so amazing was, you know, particularly among women, is just the universality of feeling like something's not right here. And we're not exactly sure what it is, but I feel confident like something's not right. So it actually wasn't a tough sell at all. And I think it was just really about the approach. I mean, because breastfeeding has become such a polarized issue, it is all about how do you approach it. And I feel that because I am a journalist, you know, people have an expectation that I'm going to bring a level of balanced reporting, you know, versus, you know, kind of just, it wasn't positioned as me just going off, which I could have done for a whole book, but but it was really positioned as, you know, researching this history, kind of taking us back to how did we get here, and really understanding some of the historical roots of some of the things that we take as commonplace today, which really shouldn't be so, and you're kind of re-examining some of the things that are going on behind the scenes that we don't even know about. So it was really meant to be about kind of talking about the things unseen, the things that we are not even aware of that are happening, that can often set us up for failure before we even begin. I mean, really, I often say that, you know, when you successfully breastfeed, whether that is for 3 weeks or 3 years, you have done so in spite of, not because of, right? So the system is set up for you to fail. And, you know, bless anyone who breaks through for any amount of time, because it is done, you know, in spite of, not because of. So, you know, and really asking the why question, you know, which is something that I always try to bring to my work, like why, you know. And I think the other part that, you know, goes with what you were saying is just kind of like, you have all these women who are, you know, the part in the book where I talk about, you know, you have all these women who are, you know, super successful, and we've just scaled new heights and we're reaching new levels in so many areas, but yet we still have this one area where we still doubt ourselves, and we believe that we don't have enough, and we believe that our bodies are not enough. And it's such a duplicitous kind of way of being around us. I was really interested in that perspective as well, and kind of figuring out, well, who told us this? Like, where do we get this idea from? You know, and it's unique around, you know, breastfeeding and birth, and really trying to go back to, we were sold that message, and because it makes, you know, there's money to be made when we are sold that message. So it's you know, some people think it's very simple, but breastfeeding is very complex, very complex.
Yes, it is. And do you feel that your book is now pulling back that curtain of mystique around this whole concept of formula versus breast milk? Do you feel, because, you know, the first four chapters here, you really did some extensive research as a journalist to talk about, you know, the concept of formula back in, you know, early history, late, you know, like 60, 70 years ago. You're talking about how these companies began its inception of sugar, you know, with these early formulas, and how, you know, so many things are still covered up in the very strategic marketing. Did you find that in your research?
Yeah, and I think what was so great about that, remember, I spent, you know, nearly 20 years as a business journalist. So for me, you know, I've been trained to always follow the money. Like, that's something that's been drilled in my head around my work for 20 years, right? So for me, this was no different. And I was most curious about the business story. Like, where was the money? Because, you know, usually whenever there's smoke, there's money burning and making
that's
a fire.
Right.
So I really wanted to help people understand, because I think in this country we oversimplify the conversation to say, oh, it's breast or bottle, oh, it's about your choice. But really, women don't truly have choice, because one, choice is requires informed decision making, and we're being fed misinformation about formula, right? We're not receiving enough accurate information about breastfeeding, because most people are relying on physicians who are ill trained or not trained at all in lactation medicine. So really, we're saying this is about choice, which it isn't, and it's not at all, even if it could be, you know. So how do we help women, whatever you choose to do, to actually have informed decision-making, to really understand why these options are available to you, for you to understand that the reason why you get formula in the hospital has nothing to do about what's best for your baby, nothing at all. It's because the hospital got paid a lot of money for the rights to give you that back. And, you know, that understanding that these things that appear to be one way actually are not is really important for women to have an awakening and an awareness to say, you know what, I'm not going to allow myself to be used in that way, right? Like, if you want to sell to me or use me for marketing purposes, at least ask me first, you know.
Exactly.
Or for women to say, you know, as we, you know, I was talking to someone today about what can moms-to-be do. Like, we have huge power as consumers. We pride ourselves, particularly when you're becoming a mother, at doing research. And, you know, we ask our pediatricians probably all sorts of questions about, do you have a well baby, a well visiting area and a sick visiting area? And what about your hours? But we didn't ask them about their knowledge of breastfeeding, right?
Right.
So there's just a lot more that we can do as women if we can have this awareness around saying, hey, there's a reason why this is going on. I'm not going to accept it at this very simple face value. I know that there's more going on here. You know, why aren't physicians trained in medical school properly around lactation science? You know, that's unacceptable. You know, why is it, and only in breastfeeding, I make this point in the book, where in the absence of unbiased information, right, so where physicians don't have the proper training at medical school, only in breastfeeding has the competitor who is supplying the substitute product stepped in to now educate the physician. So the physicians are being, quote unquote, educated by the Similac Makers Nutrition Institute, as they call it, right? It makes no sense, you know. And I make the comparison of how many of us would, you know, go visit a dietitian who was trained at Donald's Institute of Food, right? Like, it wouldn't make sense for us to kind of think that the competitor to what we're actually trying to do could be a source of unbiased information and could properly educate a physician or other professional, but when it comes to breastfeeding, that becomes socially acceptable. So these are the things we have to start looking at and stop trying to, you know, kind of keep this as a very, very, you know, it's my choice conversation when, you know, we're not talking about public health implications. We're not talking about how one choice affects others. We're not talking about, well, do we really have choice or do we just have bad options? I'm not really sure. You know, we're not talking about the fact that we don't have a paid maternity leave in this country, you know. So these are the things that it prevents us from talking about. And my hope is that with the big letdown that we start actually talking about those other issues and we stop looking at this as an individual issue but start looking up to the structural barriers that are impacting all women, you know, so we can take the conversation
absolutely.
To a new level.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And in the book, you also describe, which I found absolutely astounding, that today infant formula is a global industry with $11 billion in annual sales. $11 billion. Mm-hmm. That's an incredible amount of money for one line of product.
Incredible amount of money. That's replacing something that's free. That's replacing something that's
and,
free.
And much more natural, less complications, and, you know, I want to talk for a minute, if you can. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and I raised a really important question. I mean, obviously, we live in a capitalist society, and I'm not one to say that formula shouldn't exist. Formula needs to exist for the infants that need it. That is very, very important. But in the book, I really talk about the nuance, the line between making reasonable profit in a capitalist society and really profiteering, because the type of double-digit revenue growth that these companies have, you know, the type of double-digit revenue growth that Apple would love to have, right? Like, they have enviable revenue growth track records. What does it take for you to do that every year? Like, and what mm-hmm. it requires for you to maintain that kind of revenue growth? Is that just making profits, or is that profiteering, as in you have to now resort to unethical marketing and other means in order to maintain that? And that's the question.
Yeah.
You know, listen, if you want to make reasonable profits, make reasonable profits. But for you to maintain that sort of growth for a substitute product that has never been proven to be better than the free alternative, there really is something else going on here. And we have to start looking at, you know, the commercial interest behind how much money is being made by undermining what the one thing that women can uniquely do, right? So it is really important that we think of this as, you know, something that's important for all women to start thinking about. And not get caught up in kind of like the smoke of making this about one versus the other.
Right, right, absolutely. And also you state that the marketing budget of $500
mm-hmm.
million to $1 billion a year annually, the marketing alone, $500 million to $1 billion, that is an incredible amount of money. Could you imagine if that money was put to world hunger, what that would do?
Right.
I just have to wonder – I just have to wonder about how did women kind of lose that autonomy like that? Because now, as you know, they just
mm-hmm.
had the first baby that was grown in a Petri dish in a lab. And also now, you know, breast milk and breastfeeding have, you know, been replaced by formula feeding for many women. So much of women's reproductive capabilities and mothering and, you know, conception and pregnancy has been really slowly being replaced. Yeah, you don't really need to do that. You can do this. You know, we can do this. We can do that. So, you know, I just wonder how much further this whole spin is going to go, where after a while, we're not even going to have to worry about getting pregnant. We're just going to go somewhere, press a button, the baby comes out the slot, and, you know, some way to feed it's going to come out the slot too. So it just really, really, it's very scary to me. In your research, in your research, Kimberly, did you ever find concrete evidence that says that formula is FDA approved or not?
So, I mean, when you mean FDA approved, that language doesn't work, because the problem with formula is that it's considered a food and not a drug, and this is the problem. So if the FDA approves drugs, but formula is not technically a drug, which is why it's allowed to do what it does and create new versions and never have to go through any rigorous testing and why infants are basically kind of this one big testing pool for untested products. So because that, you only really have the GRAS, the GRAS guidelines, which is generally accepted as safe, generally regarded as safe, which, you know, doesn't require the same amount of testing and trials as a drug. So it's very interesting. And one of the points I make in the book is that, you know, there are connections. You know, nobody can make that kind of money year after year without good government collusion, as in, you know, lack of regulation. And one of the areas where this has been, you know, poorly regulated, in my opinion, is this distinction that, you know, formula is not held to the standards of drugs, that is held to the standard of a food. And, you know, considering that, you know, there is no other food that everyone eats 5 and 6 times a day, every day for 12 months straight. There is no other food, right? I mean, that could be by choice, right. But for infants, formula, if they're being formula fed, that's their only source of nutrition. It's not like me, if I eat something bad today, I could, you know, take an extra Zumba class this week or, you know, balance it out tomorrow, have a couple of salads or whatever. Like, that doesn't happen for babies. This is something that they will continuously consume, you know, for a good portion, you know, for a full year. And so to me, that lends itself to having more regulation, more scrutiny, more testing, but instead what we find is less. And to me, that's also part of the big letdown, because women deserve more about something that they're really being set up to buy, right? So if I'm going back to work in 2 weeks, you know, I'm set up to formula, unless, you know, I'm willing and able to make that huge commitment of pumping. You know, it's just a lot. So it would seem that this would be an area where they could give it more scrutiny, more testing, but instead we find less. And for me, that's really, you know, not okay. Like, that is just despicable, because we're talking about helpless infants.
Right, right. And, you know, I just find that chain that women have to go through when it comes to pregnancy, that they go through the pregnancy, prenatal care, of course, then postpartum, they're given 6 weeks before they have to think about returning back to the workforce. That's additional pressure on them. And at the same time, they're, you know, the society saying, well, we're giving you 6 weeks off, but, you know, you can still get back to work and know your baby be fed really well with this formula. And I just think if, you know, we just had a study come out here on social media that, you know, it's really recommended that a woman have a year off after giving birth, and that for them to recover and to do everything that they're supposed to do. But could you imagine if the woman had a year off, that, you know, would she be reaching for that formula bottle as quickly as opposed to 6 weeks?
Right. And the thing that I talk about in the book, Denise, that is so important, it's like, you know, when these things happen, when we're being told that our quote-unquote choice is to go back to work and pump our milk and give it to our babies, that's not really a choice, you know? And secondly, what's happening is our milk is being valued, right? So now companies are going to give you a lactation room with some nice IKEA furniture. Some companies have said they'll pay for the shipping to get it back. There's actually an anecdote in the story where I was there at a hotel concierge with a crying mom, and she missed the last FedEx pickup trying to get her milk back to her baby. You know, like, companies have said they'll cover that. But what we really need is time to mother. Like, we just we just really deserve time. And so it is, you know, it is one thing to value the product that we produce and say, okay, we get this milk is valuable, but what about me as a mother? Like, that is being devalued. It's being devalued. It's being devalued in terms of what our policy does not have. It's being devalued in saying that, listen, as long as you get your milk back, that's good enough to the mothering that goes with it. And it's a very dangerous trend for the milk to be valued, our product to be valued, but we as the producers to be devalued and not being allowed time to actually mother. So we really have to not get, you know, kind of what I call the danger of becoming a pump nation, you know, where we are getting happy that we have these nice rooms and lamps and the rocking chairs, but that quiets us from fighting for the thing that we really need, which is more paid maternity leave, a year off, time to actually mother. And that's really what we deserve. And we don't want to lose sight of that.
Absolutely. We don't want to lose sight of that. And unfortunately, society is pushing for harder, better, faster, more. And this is almost like a ridiculous request that a woman's making. You want what? You want to do what? You know, but you have this 6-7-figure career. Why, you know, get back to work. And as a certified birth doula, I find many of my professional moms, as soon as they, you know, have the baby, you know, they're having their golden hour, and a couple hours later they're thinking about, wow, I'm on the clock now. I have to get back to work by, you know, 6 or 8 weeks. I only have this amount of time off. Or they have to sacrifice for years and accrue all this amount of time, so when they go and have their baby, then they can have off 3 months or so. So either way, the woman is just under a lot of pressure to still be, you know, earning income and almost, you know, doing motherhood. Like, you can't do both. You have to choose between the other one, that kind of thing, which I think is absolutely crazy. So now, Kimberly, I was very taken by the beginning of your book. You wrote about your own experience of breastfeeding your baby, and you felt that your baby wasn't getting enough. You had a crisis, like many of our moms do. And I want you to, if you can, briefly talk about that, where, you know, you came to back to the hospital, and you know, you were looking for help. Could you just talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I opened the book with a very vivid scene that I have never forgotten. You know, and I just mentioned that my first baby is going to be 17 in May. So, but, you know, kind of like making this mad dash drive back to the hospital, really in a desperate attempt to find somebody to help me. I had been attending the breastfeeding support group there, and I'm a big fan of group. If anyone, you know, group saved me, I will tell everybody that. But, you know, this wasn't a group day. And I think at that point, the group was meeting like every other week. So I make this mad dash drive back to the hospital, and, you know, hoping that I could find somebody. I knock on the door where the support group meets, and, you know, just kind of have this moment like I don't know what to do. Like, I'm failing at this. You know, I have nobody to help me, and I just need to cry. You know, baby's crying, I'm crying, everything is falling apart. You know, I'm leaking food, like there is milk coming out of me. But for some reason, you know, it's not working. So, you know, when I walked through the story about what happened to me that day, you know, a very nice older woman named Alice came, and, you know, she was a hospital volunteer, and she saw me literally on the floor crying with my baby. And she went and found a lactation consultant who led our group and really helped me. But, you know, the point of my story was that I was saved by a stranger, right? My pediatrician was unavailable. You know, I couldn't get a lactation consultant back to my house. You know, and at the end of the day, I had to rely on my own devices, like driving myself to the hospital and sitting, you know, like crying for help. And that's not the way it should be, you know. And at that time, as a new mother, really being aware that this was not the message I was told or sold about what breastfeeding is like. And so one of the things that's really important in my work is that we, you know, are honest with women about the truth of their experience, right? And that I know that it is indeed a natural process, but it is, you know, it is also indeed unnatural in our society with so many structural barriers, with so many, you know, problems with the lack of paid maternity leave, with a culture, to your point, where we use breasts to sell chicken wings and beer, but people are uncomfortable about feeding an infant. You know, in that environment, breastfeeding is extremely unnatural. And so we have to really help women understand the truth about the experience. One of the things that I talk about a lot in my presentation is about separating the act of breastfeeding from the experience of breastfeeding. The act of breastfeeding can be wonderful and beautiful, but the experience of doing it in a country with no paid leave, you know, in a country where the breast has been over-sexualized, you know, in a place where mothering is not valued as important work, it can be extremely difficult. And I think we have to begin to be very honest with women about what that experience is like and prepare them for it so they can know it may not be all meadows and yellow flowers for you, at least not at the beginning. There can be some, you know, it certainly got better for me, you know, and I think every woman finds her rhythm, you know, but, you know, it can be a challenge. Not everybody's experience is going to be all, as they say, greens and gravy straight out the gate. So I think that's really important. Absolutely. And I love sharing that story. Mm-hmm.
Yes, absolutely. It was a very profound story because I think as a mother, many women out here have had that, oh my God, you know, what's going on episode happen. For me, it happened as a single mom, breastfeeding and cloth diapering. I was an idiot for trying to do all this stuff. And, you know, of course, at the end, I crashed with postpartum depression. But, it's really real out here. Now, I've written a blog about it called The Black Hole, where, you know, women are banged over the head for the 10 months of pregnancy. Get that prenatal care. And then when she has the baby, she's put in this black hole called 6 months checkup. Well, excuse me, 6 weeks. We'll see you in 6 weeks. And all of a sudden, all this care and support just, like, you know, can go away. What I want to talk to you about here, too, is in the Facebook event page, I have a dear friend, Ebony Jackson, who says, you know, she's listening to the show and she's blessed about breastfeeding. She has, this is her ninth baby she has, and he's an absolute doll here.
Oh, wow.
See him on, he is gorgeous. And she's saying, the support I've been given is phenomenal. I'm surrounded by people where breastfeeding is the norm. My midwife, lactation consultant, chiropractor, pediatrician, and doula. And I cannot wait to read Kimberly's book. Now, I want to talk to you about that, Kimberly, because you were saying in the description when you ran through the hallway holding your crying baby in a crisis, you were, you know, living on Long Island, you had on your Uggs, you were really on an upscale side of life. Now, what is it, or why is it that the upscale woman is not really fully embracing having a doula or a midwife or a chiropractor? Why do these resources kind of not reach women of affluence as easily? Did you know about a doula? Because I'm sure if you had a doula, you could have called her and she could have came and helped you.
That's such a great question, Denise, because I did not know about a doula. And I think, you know, one of the things that they do to us is try to put us in types, right? So, you know, for many years, kind of breastfeeding was kind of in the crunchy granola world. And, you know, because that's how they like to divide us. You know what I'm saying? Like they create stereotypes around certain things that you do, right? So, of course, if you're breastfeeding anybody past 12 months, you're doing attachment parenting and now you're in some kind of fringe group, right? So it's like, well, that's not it at all, you know? So I think that, you know, I did not even know about doulas. And this was, again, you know, 17 years ago. I wish, you know, if I could do it all again, but it's not going to happen. I would certainly, and I tell everybody about doulas. But I think that we haven't been properly educated on the value of these, you know, of doulas and things like that. And also I think as women of color, because I have a lot of women, you know, a lot of women of color, even like here in New York City area, who are doulas, and they always come up to me and they're like, I don't have any black clients. Like, you know, they're happy for the clients that they have, you know,
but it's not something that
the black community, and so I've tried to, you know, do my part to raise awareness. But I think that another part of it is, you know, as black women, we have a cultural affinity and a connection and, you know, an association with being strong. And for many of us, you know, mothering is something that we have seen our mothers and our grandparents do, and it's not easy for us to ask for help. And let me say that when I had to get help with cleaning my house or taking care of my children, I would not tell my mother. Like, I am going to say I lied to her. But you know, like, I was ashamed of that because in my mind, as a black woman, you take care of your house, you take care of your job, you take care of your man, you take care of your family. Right? Like, you don't need help for that. You know what I'm saying? And so we have a kind of cultural association with kind of doing things on our own. This is very dangerous. I'm not saying this is a good thing. I'm thinking that we need to get rid of it because these are the reasons why black women have such poor health outcomes. I think that's a key contributing factor. But I think that we don't think about needing help around our children because that's something that we do, right? In fact, we've done it for white people. We take care of their kids too, right? So, you know, that's our story around taking care of ourselves and taking care of our children until we're actually in it and realize, oh, crap, this isn't what I thought it would be, and I really wish I had some help. So, you know, I really want us to kind of better understand the role of doulas. I mean, I would have loved to have a doula, and, you know, during my labor, I mean, I had 2 C-sections. I still can't tell you why, and that's been a big source of what I call my birth regret. You know, I wrote a piece about that. So, you know, I mean, there's so much that we have to learn, and I think that a lot of it is kind of rewriting the stories we've been told about, you know, who we are, what we can do, how we do it, and us letting go, that, you know, those attachments. It was a really big deal for me to, you know, at one point I did have a carer who lived in my home, and, you know, technically, you know, she's a nanny, but I would never say that word to my mom.
Okay.
More like the babysitter's here. And then, you know, when she had to come visit, I said, okay, I'm going to have to tell the truth because she's going to see that this woman lives in my house. But, you know, like, I was embarrassed. I was embarrassed.
Right.
I was embarrassed that I needed help with my children, you know. And so, yeah, there's something cultural there. And, you know, I think that we have to better understand, like, the birth experience so we can get the support that we need. Because to your point, you know, I mean, I suffered postpartum depression. We see what it's doing to a lot of women in terms of them not healing. Mm-hmm. We have higher C-section rates. And we see what our maternal mortality rates are, mostly due to complications from C-sections. So there's so much that we could benefit from having a doula, you know, and some more care around birth. But we have to kind of retrain ourselves and re-educate ourselves on the issues so we can get the support we need.
Yeah, and you hit the nail right on the head so well again, Kimberly, because I am an African-American doula, and I have more white women as my clients than I do black women, and I do my very best to reach out to black women. But there is that hesitancy, there is that skepticism, there is that resistance that I don't know what else to do because I've offered my services for free. I've offered my services for top dollar, and it's still the same outcome when it comes to women of color, that they're very suspicious, very skeptical. And once they have the service, it's a game changer. They can't stop talking about it. They tell all their friends. They refer clients to me. But to get them to that point, to get them to that deliverance, it's really very, very hard. So I'm with you on that front line, saying that we have to change this way of thinking and learning, and it's going to be to the betterment of future generations as well. So, Kimberly, I want to talk about your chapter I liked about here, the feminist fallacy. I like that chapter a lot because, you know, like you just said, women are out here saying we're strong, we're this. We're doing everything that a man can do. We're out here earning the money, and we've got the careers and everything. I want you to talk a little bit about this chapter to our listeners.
Yeah, I mean, I take a lot of heat for this chapter, Denise. I take a lot of heat for saying feminism undermines breastfeeding, and, you know, I always try to clarify what I mean by that, you know, never to want to undermine feminism. But one of the things that's very, very clear is that, you know, in our very important quest and in our fight to be viewed as equal to men, that we forgot to fight for the things that make us uniquely women, such as birth and lactation, right? And so, you know, it was an unintended consequence at a time when, you know, the movement, and I'm using the air quotes, was, you know, did not want women to be forced to mother, right? Which is absolutely an important goal. Nobody should valorize mother, you know, mothering. But however, what if you actually choose to mother? Like, there's no support for that. And so now we see women forced into male patterns of work where you have a baby, you're supposed to be back to work in 2 weeks. Don't look like you had a baby. Don't act like you had a baby. If you start to drip because you had a baby, please go in that room and extract yourself, right? And now we're forced into these male patterns of work that don't acknowledge the ways that we are uniquely women. That's a problem,
right?
And, you know, we see that element not being supported. Secondly, you know, I really walk through what's happening to women because of breastfeeding, right? Women are being shamed because of breastfeeding. Women are being kicked out of public places because of breastfeeding.
Yes.
Women are being, you know, told to hide, to cover their bodies because of breastfeeding. You know, all of these things that are being told to women, not because someone has an issue with infant feeding. No, it's about telling a woman what to do with her body. These are the things that feminists used to be upset about, right? Like, to me, that's a feminist issue. Women are being shamed for what they do as a natural part of child rearing. We should, you know, feminists should be up in arms, but they have not embraced breastfeeding as a feminist issue. They have not looked at feminism as something that should support all the roles and identities that women play throughout their life, including the role of mother, and for someone who actually chooses to mother, and to value that as important work, not as demeaning, not as, you know, having a child dependent on you is a terrible crime against womanhood. No, that these are actually important roles that we play, and if you, nobody should be forced to, but if you choose to, you deserve support for that as well. And so, you know, that's an issue, and we have to kind of acknowledge that we did not fight for those roles. Same with reproductive rights. We have framed the reproductive rights conversation as the right to, you know, not have a baby or to terminate a pregnancy you don't want, all very important. But what about the right to actually have that child and feed it, right? So breastfeeding is a reproductive right. It completes my reproductive cycle and allows me to feed the thing that my reproductive organs produce. But we haven't looked at breastfeeding as a reproductive rights issue, and that we've only looked at reproductive rights for people who don't want to use their reproductive organs and forgot about helping the people who do want to use their reproductive organs and what happens after that. And so I think it's been a little short-sighted on both sides, and that we need to find a space to, which is happening now, a space to include mothering as valued work. And to make that part of whatever next wave of feminist conversation there is, and to understand and begin to fight for those rights, and look at, if we're having a women's movement, that it should support all the roles and identities that, you know, women may play throughout the continuum of their life, not just when they're trying to not use their reproductive organs. I believe some studies say like 80% of women will become mothers at some point in their life, and so, you know, we're really not doing a good job of the women's movement if we're forgetting a key part of, you know, a woman's identity that, you know, most women will step into at some point or another.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. That chapter just really just rang through for me, because it was like, oh, yeah, we kind of got half the horse. We fought for the horse and we got some of it, but we didn't get all of it. And that was just very, very powerful. So I don't want to give away too much of the book with that, so I'm not going to keep going on that. But it was a very powerful chapter for me, Kimberly,
Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's just really amazing. Now, we've talked about the, you know, sexualization of breasts and how women could use their breasts for, you know, selling chicken and lingerie and everything else. But when it comes to the natural capacity of our bodies, that's frowned upon. Kimberly, where do you see breastfeeding and this whole awareness and teachable moment coming down in the next 10 years? Where do you see it going?
Well, I think that right now we're at a great moment of women, you know, coming together. I mean, I think there's a lot of concern from women from our current administration. I'm hoping that concern and this, you know, seeming collectiveness and this idea that we're going to need to try to figure out how to come together on a few key points, that this is going to be a turning point for women to, you know, come together beyond the lines that I feel commercial interests have used to divide us, and also for us to, you know, kind of begin to raise our voices about the issues that matter to mothers and make sure those are not silenced as unimportant roles. So I think that turning point is going to happen really soon. And what I'm really hopeful for is that, you know, we can really kind of transform this landscape, really start demanding something different, something better. And for me, beyond that, you know, flashpoint, really begin to normalize and, you know, kind of spark this, you know, counterculture revolution and how we, like, what's the normative way to feed our kids? You know, like the normative pattern for feeding our babies, and that we could kind of bring that on. I think if not, that it's, you know, it's headed to a very dangerous place. But I feel like as women, we have the power to, you know, begin asking the questions, to begin, like I mentioned, of our physicians and of our hospitals and, you know, of our spaces and, you know, of the support that we have and of that we don't have. And really speaking to each other. Social media has been amazing in helping us, you know, kind of see the real experiences in many ways that people are having, and women are sharing their stories more. So I think all of this, you know, can be a positive influence for changing the, you know, for normalizing breastfeeding and really helping us kind of shift things to a different perspective.
Yeah, that's very, very wonderful. Now, Kimberly, you know we just finished up with the Obama administration. We had 8 years, and First Lady Michelle Obama, former First Lady Michelle Obama, did a wonderful campaign to bring about the awareness of obesity in our children in this country and to get children moving. Do you think she could have done another part of that obesity awareness and to talk about breastfeeding? Because I do know that research has shown that breastfed babies have a less chance or less evidence or distinction of becoming obese adults.
Mm-hmm. And it's so true. I mean, two things. I mean, what I love about the research that makes so much sense to me about how breastfed children have reduced risk of obesity. Breastfed children from an early age learn to eat according to their feeding cues and stop, right? They eat until they're full.
That's right.
And they stop. No one has said full equals 8 ounces or, you know,
that's
put
right.
a bottle into their mouth and feel like it has to be measured. They learn even the feeding cues. Like, this is a habit that, you know, even I have spent much money at Weight Watchers trying to relearn, right, how to eat until you're full and push it away. Right, just stop,
right.
Kimberly, just stop. So
it's
an important life skill that an infant can earn and learn from an early age. And so this is for me one of the most kind of makes so much sense to me, you know, kind of scientific evidence around breastfed children, why they have reduced risk of obesity, not to mention just, you know, the quality of breast milk. But I think that Michelle Obama did speak out about breastfeeding. She shared a personal story of being in a meeting and breastfeeding one of her girls. If you may recall, when she spoke about breastfeeding, she was immediately attacked by, at this point, Sarah Palin, Malkin or something with a B. You know, there were two kind of prominent Republican females who were quite noisy at the time, and they really jumped on it. I remember Sarah Palin's comments were something to the effect of, well, of course she's talking about breastfeeding. Have you seen the price of cow's milk? And it was just like, okay, that's not a good comparison, because if you're old enough to be, okay, never mind, Sarah. Never mind. Go back to watching Russia.
So, you can't even go there.
Right. Don't even try to break down that logically, because it's just a rabbit hole. But I say that to say, you know, it became highly politicized. You know, they were accusing her of trying to foster a nanny state and, you know, all this nonsense language. And I feel that, you know, the First Lady had to somewhat back off of it. I do feel like I've been to PHA, the Partnership for Healthy America, which is the, you know, the effort that she chaired. I spoke on a panel about breastfeeding. I feel that, you know, when I've been invited to the White House with the Department of Health and Human Services and the First Lady has spoken, she's always talked about breastfeeding. But I think there was a real political cost for her continuously publicly talking about it. And that's really sad, you know, that women,
yes, it is,
you know, would be the ones that kind of turned it into a political moment. And Sarah Palin, wasn't she like famously breastfeeding on the campaign trail? You know, so breastfeeding became politicized and that, you know, the First Lady did kind of pull back her direct messaging about breastfeeding, but, you know, she was certainly very supportive behind the scenes. And to your point, you know, it would have been great to hear more of that direct messaging, but we have
to kind of understand
the environments that we're in.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Kimberly, I have two more questions before we end our night, because I know you've had a long day and I want to know, how is your book tour going? How is it being received?
Oh, it's been really amazing. I mean, we are, you know, I started on the West Coast. I had an amazing time in L.A. I went to UC Berkeley. I did an event at Google. I was just, excuse me. I'm sorry, Denise. I was just in Chicago at the March of Dimes conference and doing some book events in Chicago. So it's been going well. Next week I am headed to, actually on Monday, I'm headed to Indiana for the Indiana Perinatal Coalition, and then I go to Chapel Hill for the Breastfeeding and Feminism Conference. Then I'm back in North Carolina doing some events in Fayetteville and with the new Hanover County WIC in early April. back to Detroit in April 24th. I'm in Philadelphia. So it's been very busy. It's been very
busy. All right.
Busy.
Very
so
good. Very good.
I would
very
definitely
good.
Love
so
everyone to kind of stay up to date with, you know, go to Kimberly Seals Dollars, check out the calendar of events to see where we're at and what we're doing. But it's been really a dynamic conversation. I'm really proud of, you know, I mean, I think for me, a book is like your baby in that, you know, you work on it, you nurture it, you feed it, you give it everything that you have, and then you put it out there. And, you know, you hope that people like it and think that it's cute, the proverbial
yeah.
think that it's cute. And, you know, so it's been real rewarding for me to, you know, see the response to the work, people talking about it, and being in different places. I mean, I love it when I go to speak at lactation-oriented conferences, but I was even more excited to be at Google, you know, and to kind of look at getting the conversation about women in the unusual spaces and to be at the School of Public Health talking to students so that the men and, you know, the young men and women there are thinking about these issues as they are going to be the next generation of policymakers. So, you know, it's been really important for me to be intentional about trying to bring the conversation to some, you know, to beyond the usual suspects.
Sure, sure. And Kimberly, I know that there's a new business on the block, and it's slowly coming forward now, and it's gaining some momentum here, Kimberly. And I'm going to say milk cafes. Now, we had a situation with Medco or someone a year and a half ago, with the women in Chicago buying up the African-American women breast milk and then reselling it for a very high profit to hospitals and to, you know, centers and stuff like that. What do you think is going to happen now? The way formula has been capitalized in this country to, like you said, you know, several billion dollars a year, do you think that the milk cafes is going to face that same exposure or contamination with capitalism?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. I mean, whenever there's commercialization of any commodity, whether that's breast milk or others, I mean, there is going to be some corruptive influence. And, you know, I think that, you know, and I actually spoke on a panel about this at UC Berkeley last year. You know, when it comes to breast milk, I mean, obviously it's important food. It's a nutrient. It takes a lot of work to get it out your body. Yeah, I'm really believing in women's autonomy and if you want to make money from that, but it needs to be a fair and equitable process. And also I'm a little concerned because I find most of these companies are run by men.
Yes.
Which is really
yes.
just, you know, kind of
here we go
as
again.
A woman
exactly.
taking me back yeah, taking us back to like a whole new sharecropping, you know, scheme. So so those are the things that concern me, and I feel like, you know, obviously the situation in Detroit was just most egregious because that was just purely extractive, you know, disrespectful of historical trauma, disrespectful of even speaking to the community to get some input. But, you know, for women that look for that option, what we need is an equitable process, and we need to make sure that women are being considered not just, again, as the producer to be, you know, managed, paid, and whatever, but as decision makers, thoughtful decision makers who can really add and shape the policy on these issues. I think this is an important area. There's a lot of legislation now going on. I know in Michigan, I know in Oregon. And so we really have to kind of watch these spaces because it is about making money from our bodies. And we have to keep an eye on it.
Absolutely, absolutely. Kimberly, before we go, of course I'm going to give you a chance to promote and give us all, you know, some happy, wonderful news on what you're going to be doing next with this wonderful project. I do have to say, as an African-American woman, I really think that your book is definitely groundbreaking. It's definitely opening those doors and pulling back those very heavy drapes. But I am a little disappointed that there wasn't a lot of resource here in the book as far as, you know, Kadada Green, Black Mothers Do Breastfeed. You know, she's doing great stuff out of I think it's Atlanta. But there's a lot of groups out here who are doing some really good stuff. And I just felt that as a woman of color, I would have loved to have seen a chapter on diversity with breastfeeding in your book, because this was such a great opportunity to have that teachable moment and to pull in the diversity and the fact that these things really are just still, with all this technology, it's still a challenge. But I know you will do that justice when you do your public speaking engagements across the country. So I'm really hoping that
I want to address that because it's such a valid point. I mean, you know that I run a project for the Kellogg Foundation that I've been working in Detroit and Philadelphia for the past 5 years. And prior to that, I've worked in New Orleans and Birmingham and Jackson, Mississippi. So The Big Letdown is a book for all women that is about the structural barriers. So, of course, in the book, I do specifically talk about the socioeconomic and the racial barriers, because whenever there's any barrier, it falls upon the most vulnerable, the heaviest, right? Whenever there's any barrier, there are those who are carrying it, who are carrying the burden the hardest. And so while I definitely do talk about the racial disparities and how, you know, that has been contributed to, one, by the feminist movement, two, by commercial interests, three, by the government because of WIC being the largest purchaser of infant formula in this country and disproportionately peddling infant formula marketing in low-income communities. I touch on all those things. What The Big Letdown is not, and I can do this additionally on the side, is it's not really a resource guide. So I'm not mentioning resources. It is a book about concepts and ideas and thinking, and it's not kind of like, you know, here's where you go to get breastfeeding support. But I appreciate that because, you know, it's certainly something that I can create as an addendum because that is so important. And, you know, Kidada and I have worked in that project for the past 3 years with me and Kellogg. And, you know, Black Mothers Breastfeeding Association is such an amazing group. And they're actually co-hosting me when I go to Detroit next month.
Wonderful.
You know, so there is so much that we can do. And in addition to Mocha Manual, I also founded Black Breastfeeding 360 about 4 years ago as a resource. So I hope, you know, people will continue to look at that, look at the stories there, and continue to be inspired and find information that they need. So it is really, really important that we don't forget that, you know, for me, whenever there's an issue, there's always a way that that issue particularly affects people of color. And I do talk about that in the book. And then hope that people will, you know, seek out resources. I'm happy to be just email me if you need something, and I'm happy to do that. But you are correct, like, resources are not a part of The Big Letdown as it is in book form. So I appreciate that feedback.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So now before you go, I'd like you to tell our listeners how they can reach you and if you're available for speaking engagements. I know you're coming up to the MISN conference in June, upstate New York, where I used to live, and Stephanie Sosnowski, I told him about you since last year, and I'm so happy to hear that, you know, you are going to be there for that. Yeah, so hopefully I will see you there. But I know you are a recipient of a Kellogg Foundation grant as well. So if you could just tell us, if you can wrap it up by just telling us what you're doing with your projects and how this book is taking you for the rest of the year, I would love to hear.
Yeah, I appreciate that so much, Denise. So my project with the Kellogg Foundation was really about kind of what we discussed, right? How do we make communities, particularly vulnerable communities, more supportive of breastfeeding? So we know that for most women, you go to the hospital, that's a 2 or 3 day stay. And while that is critically important because it's ground zero, the majority of your breastfeeding journey occurs in your community, right? Which is where I was without any support, trying to drive 30 miles back.
So, you're right.
So it's really about making sure that vulnerable communities have the support. So we've been piloting this project, and I'm really proud to have worked with KIDADA for the past 3 years on this, where we piloted in Detroit and Philadelphia to actually create a model that can be nationally replicated that's about accreditation. What does a community need to look like? You know, and for us, that means all the basic touch points, whether that's businesses, restaurants, childcare centers, the mall, any place that a mom needs to go in her daily life, because, you know, moms have things to do, and not everybody has the luxury to just sit at home and breastfeed, so you need to be able to do it and take care of yourself and your family. But what's so great about this project, Denise, is not just, we did not go in there to say, hey, here's what you should do, businesses, to be more supportive of breastfeeding. We actually recruited groups of women in from the community. We took them through a training that was a proprietary training that KIDADA developed, helped them. We say the community is the expert here. We don't come in as experts. We believe that the community has the power to save itself, and that we trust that they have the experiential knowledge. They know their community best. We're going to give them the tools. So in our project, women, these women design the interventions that they think will work best, and then they actually go out and execute them via a three-week paid internship program. While they're in our internship program executing these ideas in their community, they're also receiving job skills training. They're receiving things that are going to help them, you know, get a leg up on life, because we know that dealing with social stressors is really critical to the success of breastfeeding and to the success of normalizing breastfeeding, because if people feel like they're worried about their jobs or how they're going to provide, they are less likely to breastfeed, and they're not even trying to hear our message. So I'm really excited about that project. It just completed in December, and I'm in the process of reporting to the foundation. And I'm real excited about sharing what we learned and, you know, letting the community hear about the women that were in our program. So I look forward to really kind of disseminating that, you know, by May or June. Secondly, that's my wonderful project, and I would love everyone to go check out befirstfruitfriendly.org to learn more about what we're doing there. As regards to the big letdown, you know, it's just been an exciting journey. You know, I mentioned some of the dates that we have coming up where, you know, I have dates all the way through August at this point in Virginia as well. So, again, just real excited. Would love people to stay connected with me. You can follow me on Twitter at IMKSealsAllers. You can go to the website, KimberlySealsAllers.com. If you have read the book, please leave a nice review. And you enjoyed the book, please leave a review on Amazon. That's really a big ask. And just keep the conversation going. I mean, what I really want to do is really change how we're talking about this issue, raise that level of conversation to look up at these bigger issues, and let's kind of get together to figure out how we can actually push for some of the changes that we know are so necessary for us and for our babies.
Absolutely. Kimberly, that's wonderful. And I would ask you if you can do one more favor for me and go to the Facebook event page for tonight and put your information there so people have a place to go where they know that your resources, your information is there, and they can reach out to you and definitely help you promote and move this project along across the nation. That is absolutely wonderful.
That is so wonderful. Good. I definitely will.
Yeah, so Kimberly, once again, it's been a long evening. I can't thank you enough for being on my show. I mean, I am so happy and proud of you for the work that you're doing and you continue to do. And I admire you. You are very smart. Your book, to me, like I said, is one of the top documents on the history of breast milk and breastfeeding, and filled with evidence-based research that you've done. And I'm just so happy about this book, and I'm promoting it as much as I can myself, because it really is a testimony of how passionate you are about the work you do, and I think you're a phenomenal journalist. So thank you once again.
Thank you so much for having me, Denise. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. So, listeners, we're going to end the show for tonight. It is going to be archived, so Kimberly, you can come back and use this link whenever you like. And also, please note, Kimberly, that the door is open if you'd ever like to come back on the show and talk about any future projects that you're doing, or if you need my help as a doula, consider it done. My door is always open to you. And once again, Kimberly, thank you so very, very much.
Thank you. Have a good night.
Yes, good night, Kimberly. Listeners, this call is going to be archived for tonight for the show, so you can listen to it on your own. The book, The Big Letdown, How Medicine, Big Business, and Feminism Undermines Breastfeeding, is for sale at all bookstores and Amazon and Barnes & Noble. It's an e-book as well. You can read it on your reading device. It's a wonderful book for students who are getting into maternal health. I strongly advise you to pick up this book because it is filled with so much research and evidence-based material that Kimberly really did her work to give us a concise resource at our fingertips. I'm reading things in this book that I've never encountered before in any of my education as a doula or as a medical social worker, so I'm really excited about it. We're going to have some more future shows coming up here with some wonderful guests again. But once again, tonight we had Kimberly Seals-Allers on to talk about her new book. It is Catching Fire. If you would like to reach out to her, please do. I put all the contact information on the Facebook group page as well as the summary of the show tonight. So if you would like for her to do a speaking engagement, please contact her publicist at her publication house, and they will definitely get in touch with you. I'm Denise Bowles. I'm known as Bold Doula. Thank you so much for joining me tonight. You can find me here on Blog Talk Radio or at my webpage of Bold Doula, www.bolddoula.com, or on Facebook under Denise Bowles. Thank you so much, everyone, and have a wonderful evening.